later in Macro Sunday.
So, Danny, allow me to play the devil's advocate here. You know I have sympathy for your view on dollar interest rates, but for the sake of discussion here, we have seen pockets of weakness in the U.S. economy, both in manufacturing to a certain extent, but also in commercial real estate. Yep. So what could wrongfoot your view on 25 interest rates? Is it the commercial real estate sector that you're watching?
Commercial real estate is not much of a concern to me. You know, I there was some good research out there by I think it was Fed economists that stress tested, you know, CRE. And so if you were to do assumptions of a default cycle similar to what they had in 2008, which was like 10% default rate.
You're listening to Macro Sunday, hosted by Andreas Dino.
Howdy, folks, and welcome to the Macro Sunday podcast. I'm Andreas Steno, founder and CEO of Steno Research, and as per usual, joined by my co-host, Mikkel Rosenwald. Welcome to you.
Thanks a lot.
Head of Geopolitics here at Steno Research. In 10-15 minutes' time, we're joined by a great buy-side specialist, named Danny Dayan from DWD Partners, and he's been fairly vocal lately. Also ahead of the CPI print last week, that the Federal Reserve is caught off guard in this reacceleration of inflation. So I'm very curious to hear his takes after the inflation report. Is it still worthwhile pursuing this story that the Federal Reserve is off? I have my doubts after seeing the move this week, but let's save that discussion for Danny. Mikkel, I'll allow you to give a brief intro to the week that just went by on stenoresearch.com.
Absolutely. Obviously, a lot of focus on the US CPI print and on reflation central banks. We'll get back into that a little bit. But a major focus on crypto as well. We're getting closer to the Bitcoin halving expected on April 20th. Our crypto analyst, Mats, did a great piece in his Crypto Move series, his Crypto Crisp as well. And you can check in. We'll post a link in the description if you want. Some strategies for how to approach this Bitcoin halving, which has tremendous effect on the entire crypto environment. So check that out. You can sign up for a free 14-day trial at stenoresearch.com, obviously. Access all of our research on geopolitics, crypto, macro, central banks, inflation, what have you. So go check that out. We may invite Mats next week, I think.
Yeah,
could be good. Getting closer to the Bitcoin halving. So, Andreas, two main topics before we switch over to the interview with Danny. The US CPI, what are your main takeaways?
Well, it was hot. I guess that's the short and sweet conclusion. It printed smack dab at our forecasts at 0.4 on the month. A couple of categories being the main culprits here again. Car insurance. Someone tweeted to me that, well, I guess that's the result of immigration. I don't know whether that's got any truth to it.
That's a bit harsh.
But that was one of the takeaways I got on X.com. Joking aside, it is still a relatively broad-based inflation picture, especially in services. We do see some declines in the car prices. Whether that's going to continue depends a lot on trade ties between China and the U.S., in my opinion. We obviously see that deflation in car prices coming out of China. But if we judge from the export data from China, it seems like it will impact Europe a lot more than the US due to much more direct trade ties on cars. We also see it when we're walking the streets in Copenhagen now, Mikkel. We see Hongxi's, XPeng's, BYD's, etc. all over the place. If you had asked me 3-4 years ago whether a Danish consumer would buy a Chinese car, I would have said no. But here we are. They're simply too cheap to ignore. And that matters a lot for the European inflation basket, not to the same extent for the US basket. Yep. So I guess overall we're looking at a picture of at the very, very, very best, a stabilizing picture in U.S. inflation at a plateau around 3.5. Obviously too high to take comfort in. The market reaction was fierce. And the question is now whether all of the hopes of that soft landing in inflation terms are taken off the table by investors. Currently, I'm kind of stuck with the vibe that we have a lot of blood on the streets in interest rate space over the past week. A lot of people were obviously annoyed with the victory lap I took on Bloomberg chats, etc., with this inflation print. So we had it right, but positioning was obviously very soft into this CPI. So there are no reasons at all to cut for the interest for the Federal Reserve right now. To be honest, no reasons at all.
So the cutting season is called off basically for 2024 or what?
Well, the big thing here is that I mean the market has now moved towards, well, pricing in very little for 24. I guess the market is still stuck in like one or two land for interest rate cuts this year. I wouldn't rule that out, but my base case would be zero. The big question here is 25 now, because we've started to see moves in the forward pricing of SOFR interest rates into 25. And if the economy is actually re-accelerating, it's debatable still. 25 is the big battleground now, because, I mean, to a certain extent, we're postponing expectations of cuts into 25 instead of having them in the autumn of 24. That's obviously completely off if this is an actual re-acceleration and not just a temporary uptick. So I think 25 is where you should sort of focus your attention now in interest rate space. And I see pretty decent value in paying interest rates into 25.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And we're getting a lot of questions on the current commodity rally, which is rather broad across precious metals, industrial metals, etc. What does this mean for that entire storyline?
Well, I guess inflation is kind of reflecting that to a certain extent, especially the moves that we've seen in industrial metals. We also got the PPI out of the US this week, and it surprised us to the downside, very much driven by seasonal adjustments in energy. Admittedly, March is typically a strong month for energy commodities, and it seems like this seasonal adjustment wreaked kind of havoc with our view on PPI, the producer price index. Point being here that March, at least if you look at it historically, is for some reason a relatively strong month for energy prices. So if we get a continuation into April, that is where you should really start to watch the effects on inflation. When it comes to metals, I think the interesting thing here is that should the Federal Reserve decide not to cut this year, we're talking about new pressures upwards on the dollar versus Asian FX. And the upwards pressure on the dollar versus Asian currencies has been the main driver behind the flow seen in gold and silver, because of Asians using gold in particular as a release valve for the debasement of their local currency. So I tend to think that this is positive for the precious metal story still, also partially for the industrial metals. So overall, yes, the commodity rally is still intact.
Very interesting. Let's head home to Europe. Mrs. Lagarde, I saw the headlines of her announcement was that she was preparing markets for the first rate cut to come in June.
Yes.
Did she prepare markets for that?
Well, I mean, the meeting is live. She obviously admitted to the meeting being a live decision on whether to cut rates or not. But it wasn't that pre-announcement that a lot of people had expected. By Mario Draghi would have done this in another way, if you ask me. So the former president, he would have announced that unless something materially changes, we're going to cut. Mm. While it's kind of upside down with Lagarde, it's a lot of ifs. Should this and this happen, we may end up with a discussion on whether to cut. I mean, it's not crystal clear at all.
No.
So yes, I think the base case
for some changes or deviations.
I think she's scared of what's ongoing in commodity space. She knows how the oil futures, natural gas futures, electricity futures, carbon emission futures, food futures, They feed automatically into the staff projections of the European Central Bank. And currently, the net picture is relatively hawkish in terms of the adjustments that they will make in June, meaning that they will have to cut despite potentially increasing their inflation forecast towards the end of the year. I've been banging the drum on this divergence between the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve, but it seems like they are a little bit scared of moving ahead of the Fed, even though she spent most of the press conference saying that she could not care less about the Fed, but they obviously do.
Yeah. We'll get back to how we are trading some of these moves and signals. Yeah. But I think for now, let's head over to the interview with Danny Dayan.
Yeah, let's do it. You motherfuckers know what time it is. I don't even know why I'm on this track. Y'all niggas ain't even on my level. I'm gonna let my little homies ride on you bitch made ass bad boy. Bitch. Feel. Get out the way, yo. Get out the way, yo. Biggie Smalls just got dropped. Little move past the mat. And let me hit him in his back. Frank Wright needs to get spanked right for setting traps. Little accident murderer. And I ain't never heard of ya. Poisonous cats attack when I'm serving ya. Spank and shake your whole style when I can't. Guard your rank cause I'ma slam your ass in the paint. It's now my great pleasure to introduce Danny Dayan, former DWD Partners, now writing on Substack, being very vocal around the Federal Reserve and Fed Funds future path. Danny, it's a pleasure to host you here at Macro Sunday. Thank you very much for joining us.
Andreas, thanks for having me. I love your podcast. I listen to it every Sunday, whether it's, you know, in the morning with coffee on YouTube or sometimes on the, you know, on the headphones at the gym. So thanks for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure, Danny. You've been very vocal lately that the inflation cycle was reaccelerating in the US. And I mean, oh boy, we got evidence of that this week. So now that you've seen the inflation evidence from March, what are your takeaways? Is this still a story that is wrong-footing the market out there?
Yes. And so I came out with a call last week that I put out in a note on Sunday that I think the Fed will have to hike again. It's my base case that I expect them to hike again. And it wasn't even contingent on this print coming in super hot like it did. It's more about three main, you know, reasons. Obviously, the inflation data we got yesterday only contributes to this, you know, view of mine, adds to the view of mine. But the three main reasons to me is, number one, the totality of growth data that we're seeing is far stronger than what, you know, people expected, including the Fed. And, you know, we have multiple quarters in a row where we're growing nominal GDP well over 6%. It looks like we're tracking that way for, you know, Q1 as well. With real GDP, I think tracking is like 2.8, but then inflation is well over 3. And so you're going to have something like 6%+ nominal GDP. So, you know, that has been the big story that I think the Fed has misjudged the economy entirely. But now what we're seeing as well is other aspects of growth are picking up. Manufacturing is bottomed. That's the good sector of things. And it's corroborated globally, where Asia is actually picking up pretty nicely. You saw export data from Taiwan, Korea, China, all doing well. PMIs in China a little up. And then, you know, last but not least, commodities. You know, so when we look at commodities in 2022, the last major, you know, bull move that we had in overall commodities, you know, that was due to fears of supply shocks, right? Russia was, their oil was pulled from the market, or fears of a big amount of their oil being pulled from the market, grains from Ukraine being disrupted, whatnot. We don't have major supply issues in the last few months. So the only thing that's changed is that demand has improved. So I think, you know, the Fed has really misjudged, you know, the economy, and now there are aspects of reacceleration. The second thing to me, I would kind of say, the second, you know, reason I think that they'll have to hike is financial conditions. And so, you know, when they came in December and did their pivot, I knew immediately this was a mistake, you know, telegraphing what you may or may not do 6-9 months from now was going to let the markets go haywire. But let's just take a, you know, from their perspective, what they were trying to do. They were trying to tell us the reaction function. They weren't telling us we're cutting today. They're telling us if real GDP is 1.2 and unemployment is 4.2 and inflation continues to moderate, you know, we will cut 3 times on expectation. Now, obviously, the markets went haywire. The economy has reaccelerated. And what we've seen to start the year is that, you know, as the data's come in hot, they've pushed back on rate cuts. And, you know, that has taken us from something like 8 max cuts to 1.5 today. And yet financial conditions have not tightened at all. In fact, they've even loosened further. So this tells me that the Fed's messaging, they've lost control of financial conditions. They no longer control financial conditions just from their verbal messaging, their speeches, their, you know, signals and cues. It's the only way they can regain control of financial conditions is to make a hawkish tilt. And that involves at least threatening hikes to be back on the table. Otherwise, I don't think they'll succeed in tightening conditions. And then last but not least would be inflation. The third, you know, core reason is clearly it's sticky. It looks to me sticky around the 3.5% level. We've had some reacceleration, you know, to start the year. I don't necessarily think we have a second wave on our hands yet. To me, that will either come from a 2022 style supply shock or lending picks up. Now, this is the big wild card. I can't predict what, you know, hundreds or thousands of banks are going to do in aggregate. But, you know, if you look at the banking sector, they essentially have been expanding their balance sheet very, very modestly, like 2 to 3% year over year, down from like 10% previously. And obviously, some of the smaller banks took some pain last year. And instead of raising capital, what they've done is basically say, we're not going to grow our balance sheet much and we'll repair equity capital organically. Well, you know, fast forward a year and things haven't worsened. And you look at the economy, it's quite strong. The household sector is quite strong. The corporate sector is quite strong. You know, the wild card is, do banks say, I need to make money again and start lending? You know, even the big banks, they're quite healthy. They actually, instead of increasing their lending, some of the big banks went ahead and bought more securities in Q4 after the Fed pivot, which is again a disaster. So now you have to say, maybe we need to stop trying to top tick bond yields and we need to focus on lending. This is the big wild card that would lead to a third wave. So all of these things tell me that policy is actually loose, not tight. The risk is far more to a second wave than to a recession near term. And so that's what leads me to say that they're going to hike. Now, for your readers and listeners to, you know, I don't want them to think I think they're turning around and hiking in May or June. I think it'll be a more complicated pathway to get there, which we can discuss certainly. But, you know, that's where I think they're ultimately going to have to hike again.
Yeah, but Danny, that's exactly my next question. If we look at forward pricing right now, obviously cuts are priced out of 2024. But if we look at the SOFR curve in 25 and even in 26, we haven't seen a lot of movement in 25 and 26 on the back of this. So if you're right that the economy is actually reaccelerating here, that's essentially the path ahead. 25, 26 is the place to look, right?
Yes. Yeah. I put on a starter position for a put spread in June 25 SOFR. Part of it is I don't want to isolate for any given meeting. So even though I think they could start in December, I certainly don't think they would hike before the election. Unless they absolutely had to, I don't expect them to hike before the election. I think, you know, more likely as we get something in December, if inflation remains where it is, I think they'll start to get really uncomfortable about how embedded it is in psychology. You know, after 4 years of being above target, you know, they could say they're comfortable now, but I don't think they'll be comfortable by year end. So June 25, I put a put spread on for 6%, you know, policy rates, which takes out the cuts, and then also for two more hikes. It's about a 10 to 1 trade. You know, when I put it on yesterday, you know, it's something that I think if I see more data, I'll put on over time. You know, it's not a sizable position right now. But that's where I think the juice is. And, you know, I think the really challenging thing for the Fed is going to be the June FOMC meeting. Because, like I said, I think they're going to be handcuffed to do nothing until December. And so they need to understand that the economy and the markets can run away from them from June till December. And if their inability to tighten conditions through messaging persists, then they need to really put out a strong message at June to hopefully buy them time so they don't have to hike at the end of the year. And so that's where it gets tricky, is where I think in June, they need to come out and take away their dovish. They're on a dovish hold, right? They were a neutral stance. And then in December, they went dovish hold with the expectation the next move is cut. I think they need to, at a minimum, get back to a neutral stance and say, we're symmetrical to hikes and cuts. Hmm. We'll see which one. You know, not saying they want to guide towards hikes that may or may not happen, but they want to get to a neutral stance and say, you know, the cuts are off the table for now. We're not even thinking about it and talking about it unless data turns. And hikes are not our base case, but if the data persists, we may need to do that. I think that is a way for them to buy time. I don't think it works. I think the markets are going to continue to call their bluff. You know, you look at even yesterday, the equity market, you know, down 95 bips, VIX barely moved up a little bit. Nobody's panicking. They've really lost control of financial conditions. So I think their June meeting is crucial for them to signal a change in reaction function. And they never move quickly. It's, you know, they always go in stages. And so I think that's upon us.
But Danny, assuming that they keep the dovish lean intact into the election season in the second half of the year, and we continue to see this reaccelerating picture in inflation and growth, how do you see cross-asset markets behaving in such a scenario?
Well, that's the key thing that we've seen in the last 2 months, is the markets are starting to question their credibility, you know, because their dovish stance was very misplaced. And, you know, the statements we get from them, financial conditions are restrictive, is just, you know, analytically indefensible. You know, their focus on a myopic Fed funds minus invisible neutral rate estimate that they have, that's way too low. But they say that that tells them they're very restrictive. This is their entire analytical framework at the moment. And it's been proven wrong, you know, I think, by the economy just remaining strong. You know, we've been above 5% for almost 12 months on the Fed funds rate. And, you know, the economy is doing just fine. Credit markets, you know, they don't like to focus on equities in the financial conditions aspect of things. And I understand that, you know, equities, in fact, have rallied right up to recessions many times and then turned south. So, you know, in this cycle, I think equities are a better forward-looking indicator than bonds. But I understand their reluctance to include it. But if you look at credit, everything tells me policy is too loose, not tight. So, you know, as the markets continue to question their credibility, that's why you're seeing gold flying. You know, gold right now has this really special, you know, place where typically this would be expressed via a weaker dollar, a substantially weaker dollar. But the other central banks have justifiable cases to cut. Like, you know, the ECB was, I think, handling things today very poorly. As an example, Bank of Canada yesterday handling things very poorly. But you know, ultimately, it's hard to get majorly bearish the dollar if these other central banks, you know, have a justifiable reason to turn around and cut at a time when the Fed may be on hold or even hike further. So the dollar hasn't been that transmission mechanism. It probably would be tightening. It probably would be rallying, given we've taken out the cuts. And so the fact that it's mostly not moving much is probably that weaker dollar, you know, feature. But the gold markets, you know, they're telling us, you know, that inflation is a major concern. Hold real assets. I think it's overbought near term. It's not like I think, you know, gold is going to collapse and unwind this move. I do think it's a bit overbought, and people will start to take profits. But ultimately, I think there's more to go in these sort of you know, credibility trades, and equities are one of them too. You know, equities keep flying.
So, Danny, allow me to play the devil's advocate here. You know, I have sympathy for your view on dollar interest rates, but for the sake of discussion here, we have seen pockets of weakness in the U.S. economy, both in manufacturing to a certain extent, but also in commercial real estate. Yep. So what could wrongfoot your view on 25 interest rates? Is it the commercial real estate sector that you're watching?
Commercial real estate is not much of a concern to me. There was some good research out there by I think it was Fed economists that stress tested, you know, CRE. And so if you were to do assumptions of a default cycle similar to what they had in 2008, which was like 10% default rate, you know, we roughly have a 3 and 4% default rate at the moment, as bad as it is. And if you had a 10% default rate with 20% recovery rate, keep in mind, banks have provisioned for a lot. You know, maybe they haven't provisioned for a 10% default rate, but they have provisioned for some. So it, what matters is how much they've provisioned. You know, in that case, you're looking at 80 billion aggregate losses across the entire financial system. And it's important to note that that takes place over time. This doesn't all happen in one wily coyote moment. It takes place over many years as these refinancings and restructurings happen. In fact, in recent weeks, you know, Torsten Slok does a great job of, you know, posting daily credit charts. And, you know, CRE prices have actually inched up. I wouldn't call it a big move, but inched up a little bit, which tells me, you know, it actually may be the worst. The worst may be past, in my opinion. But it's not something like that. I think, you know, it could be, you know, some of these weaker, you know, lower income groups and the issues that they're struggling with, you know, higher prices and higher rates, it could be that. Okay, so if that compounds and expands further, you know, it could certainly start to weigh on demand. You know, maybe some signs of this in services, you know, PMIs were a little weaker than we expected. We'll see. I think that is entirely possible. There was a great paper from Larry Summers at Harvard where he analyzed why consumer confidence is so weak. And, you know, I think this was a telling paper. And it also makes a complex story for the Fed, frankly. But the paper basically looked at consumer confidence has historically been correlated with the misery index. I don't know if you're familiar with the misery index, but it's unemployment rate plus inflation rate. And, you know, unemployment's very low and inflation rate, you know, has come back down to more moderate levels. So this would imply that consumer confidence should be way higher, and yet it isn't. And what they analyzed is if you actually go back to the pre-1981, you know, CPI calculation, where you included financing costs in the calculus, you end up as of November, which I think was the last data they had, you still have an 8% inflation rate, you know, at that point. And that's more consistent with what consumers are saying they're feeling than the official data. And what, you know, it tells you is importantly that, you know, the increased interest rates are having some impact on at least consumer confidence. And so that could weigh on the economy over time. It certainly can. I mean, we haven't seen it. I think what's missed in this analysis is the wealth gains kind of offset, more than offset this, you know, 50 trillion plus wealth gains since 2020. Obviously, that's concentrated in higher income brackets. But, you know, there's a lot of offsets to any negative things that you come up with. But the complex thing about that paper from Larry Summers, or my takeaway from it, is lowering rates modestly, you know, in an adjustment cut scenario may not help. It actually may make it worse because households are looking at things like housing and cars. And, you know, we exclude financing costs from these, but nobody buys these things without financing costs. It's part of the calculus of buying a car. Nobody, you know, other than hip hop videos, nobody walks into a dealership and buys a car in cash. You know, it's bought with financing, whether it's lease costs or, you know, you take out a loan. And obviously, same with housing. So, you know, when you may have a situation where they move rates down, let's say 50 bips, 75 bips, adjustment style, housing prices and car prices go up, the affordability situation may actually worsen with those cuts. So it really pours cold water to me on soft landing as a concept, because the solution where you get rates down and affordability improves, prices come down, is a recession. And so, you know, I think we're going to slowly move towards the Fed actively trying to weaken the economy. This whole stance of, you know, we'll tolerate very strong growth and cut rates, I think is has to be thrown out the window. I think they need to start talking about, you know, weakening the economy. Maybe not recession, but they need to at least weaken the economy for these dynamics to actually play out. But, you know, they haven't shown an appetite for it. And so that's where we are right now.
Speaking of financing costs, Danny, we obviously have a completely different duration profile of mortgages compared to the period just ahead of the great financial crisis. Yep. So given this much longer duration profile, is it even possible for the Federal Reserve to impact the resi real estate market to any major extent here?
I do think they can, but it's difficult for them because they don't control the back end of the curve. So, you know, the markets are going to move the back end of the curve based on, you know, a lot of different factors. Mm-hmm. Supply is one, policy rate expectations are another, you know, the term premium story, which we had a little bit of last year. But when we had a 5% 10-year last year, you know, we had an 8% mortgage rate. You did see some moderation in housing activity, and you did see financial conditions tighten, and you did see equity prices move lower, which hurts household wealth. You did see the dollar come in stronger, which reduces import prices. So you did see those things. I think, you know, now you're not going to erase the wealth that's been created. You can maybe cause people to take profits here, but you're not going to erase all of it. I think now, you know, what would get me away from a rate hike scenario? So we got the 10-year to something like 5.5. You know, don't be super specific about it, but in that ballpark, and it stayed there for 3 to 6 months. Now, is that realistic? And this is where I'm pessimistic about it. Is, you know, we've seen these financial conditions tightening periods, and then the markets or the economy are looking for that to reverse. They're looking for easing. It's just the natural state of things is financial conditions to ease. And all it will take is some, you know, one slip up in a Fed speech or something like that, or Yellen tilts back to bills on May 1st or whatever it may be that'll actually cause financial conditions to just reverse. And if the 10-year went back to 4% from, you know, 4.5 now, I think that's stimulous. And so the challenge is, without doing active sales from their balance sheet, they cannot directly impact the 10-year, which I think is the biggest, you know, policy error that they have had, is not targeting long-end yields, long-end rates, which are more impactful on the economy than the Fed funds. Nobody transacts at the Fed funds rate. And so they need to use the Fed funds rate to push back-end rates higher, which they haven't been super successful of doing. And again, I think it comes to the reasons why are, one, you know, even as they were hiking 75 bips a clip, they were still forecasting cuts down the road, you know? And so they've contributed to the curve shape by their messaging. And two, the neutral rate estimate has been 2.5, now 2.6, whoop-de-doo. But, you know, now it's 2.6. And, you know, that has also led to the markets pricing this inverted curve more than it should be. And it's resulted in no term premium in the back end. So that's where my messaging, you know, policy recommendation for them for June would be: eliminate all the cuts and say we are symmetrical. And if we need to cut, we can turn around and cut next meeting if the economy weakens. But we don't need to, you know, it's not our base case right now. And our base case is we're symmetrical to either hikes or cuts. And so that's where we're back to on hold, you know, permanently. And that may get the tightening that they need. As I said, I'm skeptical, but it's possible.
Danny, the other week I traveled a couple of handful of hedge funds in London, and one of the topics that came up in almost every meeting was obviously the presidential election this autumn. And I'd like your take on the base case of all of these hedge funds, because it was an extremely uniform expectation of Donald Trump regaining the presidency. I see a major divergence between bookmaker odds and the financial consensus, if you know what I mean. So what's your take on the presidential election, and does it matter for your view on the economic momentum into 2024?
I got to tell you, I wish I could just fast forward to after the election and then do the analysis on what we have to deal with, because I think it's going to be a horrific election season to pay attention to. And it's going to start when we have debates and rallies and things like that. It's going to start to get more contentious. I do think there's a general dissatisfaction with Joe Biden. Partially, there are concerns about his age. That's one thing, certainly. But there's also dissatisfaction with how he's handled, everything from the economy. And I think more importantly, foreign policy. People are very frustrated with his foreign policies, the Afghanistan withdrawal, his, sort of flip-flopping support for Israel, flip-flopping on providing, what they say their goals are for Ukraine. It's unclear really what, just open-ended support, but no real plan at this stage for Ukraine to make progress or end the war. And I think, he's viewed, rightfully so, as weak on foreign policy at a time where it's a very dangerous world, where we have a lot of enemies, and that the enemies see his policy as, he's more accommodative and trying to appease, different audiences rather than be confrontational. It doesn't mean Trump is good on foreign policy, but he's, he's a bad guy, so to speak. He'll tweet at 2 a.m, fire and blood to North Korea, or he'll tweet, he probably would be a lot tougher on Qatar, in their involvement of the Israel war. So I think, I lean towards him taking it. That being said, we could get into the last month or two and he opens his mouth and says something absolutely ridiculous. And when people get to the ballot box, they just may not be able to pull the trigger on him because they don't like him. And so, that's difficult. I think the harder thing to really analyze here is what's going to happen to fiscal policy, after the election, depending on the candidate. The expectation is that if Biden wins, he wins without the majority. Sweeping majority. But if Trump wins, that he may get the majority. So if Trump wins, I would expect extension of tax cuts, which is another trillion plus or trillion and a half of spending. I expect, other forms of infrastructure spending. I expect him to get more active in, the southern border and building something there again, more construction spending. So I think he'll be a little bit more expansive with the budget than Biden will be, not that Biden doesn't want to, because I don't think Biden will have the bullets to do it. The real concern that, is will he try to influence Powell and the Fed? And it's unclear to me. Everyone thinks he's a low rates guy because he's a real estate guy, and he was, applying pressure on the Fed last cycle to cut rates. But I view him more as someone who responds to the pulse of what, the middle class kind of responds to. And so if the middle class is saying the biggest issue is inflation, and, I don't know that he's going to push for rate cuts. He may actually push the other direction or on hold. I don't think he'll want a recession, but he may be on, stay on hold at a higher level. So that to me may be something that's confusing to people, is his stance on monetary policy and whether he applies pressure there. I think it's really tough to see, to prepare from an investment standpoint for this at this stage. It's very, very difficult.
Yeah. I perfectly agree, Danny. It was such a pleasure hosting you here at Macro Sunday. And the final question for you, if our audience want to follow you online, where do they find your Substack and your online feed, Danny?
So I've in the last 12 months started to be a little bit more active on Twitter, after avoiding it most of my career. Danny Diane 5 is my Twitter handle. You can find me there. And in the profile, I have my link to my Substack. On the Substack, I'm putting out whatever I find interesting. So it's different than, the typical research providing where, there's, forecasting and things of that nature. I'm not doing that. It's more, here's my overall big picture macro views. Here's trades I like, here's, quick hitting thoughts, reactions to data, things like that. So, it's new and it's gotten good feedback so far. So, definitely check it out if you're interested.
Yeah, I've certainly enjoyed it myself, Danny. Thank you very much for being with us here at Macro Sunday, and we hope to see you back on the show later this year.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to that. Take care, Andreas.
So back from the interview with Danny, really interesting stuff. Andreas, I just want to touch upon before we finish this podcast and a couple of topics that we've been covering on standardresearch.com this past week. You wrote an emerging markets piece called China's Preparing for Something Big. A lot of different meanings to that, but that aside, let's start with how do you see that China's preparing for something? Then we'll get back to what this big thing is.
I'm sounding like Andrew Tate nowadays.
Emergency meeting.
Something big is happening. I can sense it. It's a typical Andrew Tate thing.
Absolutely.
Point being here that, I mean, something is clearly ongoing when you watch the stockpiling of copper in China. And as soon as an inventory like copper is exploding in China to the upside, and we are adjusting for the seasonal effects here, all of the tinfoil hats out there emerge from the dark web with all sorts of theories of what's ongoing.
Copperfoil hats.
Yeah, copperfoil hats. Yeah. I think the simple explanation why they're building up stock in copper is that they're basically trying to secure the supply chain in several areas within green tech. They need a lot of copper for that. EVs, wind turbines, solar panels. And it's quite clear when you watch the import data that they're trying to subsidize their way into the European market in particular on these three green tech areas, obviously also other markets globally. So I'm not necessarily of the view that this preparation for something big is driven by anything else but capitalism or state capitalism, call it whatever you want, from China. And I mean, I've seen stories emerging on whether this could be like preparation for a larger focus on weaponry ahead of an invasion of Taiwan, stuff like that. Export numbers on weapons are down, and I mean, do you put any emphasis on those rumors?
Not the war angle. I mean, copper is not the last thing you would stockpile, but it's certainly not the first thing you would stockpile when heading into war. Even though war is also getting more digital. One theory that makes some sense politically, we must address them whenever we try and decipher what the central government of China is doing. It is pretty much a black box. It is for almost everyone. One theory that makes sense is that China has really chosen to gamble on the EV sector, which is also pretty much what you said, both with an export focus, especially for Europe, especially perhaps if Tesla, as rumored, decides not to push out a cheaper version of their cars, could be connected to that. And also to sort of make the next wave of Chinese progress one where each Chinese gets a car. It's the old Volkswagen strategy. Yeah. And it does rhyme quite well with what we've seen in the past for the Chinese government. I mean, now people have been moved to the cities. They're owned their own homes. They're indebted for it.
Now
they probably need an EV, and even more Chinese do that. And by pushing this car and producing cars at this level, they will also be producing cars for the entire global south and preparing themselves to enter the upcoming, the Indian EV market and the African EV market in the coming decades. So that could be a long-term explanation for this. Could also simply be someone in local governments overreacting to signals from the central government.
But let me put it like this, Mikkel. We're talking about EV sales as a percent of the total car sales of roughly 20-25% on a monthly basis in China right now. You don't have a lot of countries on earth with such a high portion of EVs relative to the total car sales. And that's to me interesting because obviously if the plan is to allow all Chinese people to drive EVs, you obviously need a major overhaul of the electrical grid, right? Yeah. And you need a lot of copper for that.
Exactly.
So I guess that could also be like the domestic explanation behind this stockpiling of copper. Yeah. And I mean, the war angle, I don't know whether you win wars with Hongxi's.
Or the simple explanation, they think it's cheap right now. I think they'll be needing a lot of that in the future. It could be as simple as that, which buys into this case, yeah. So another chart from this article that interests me was the we've been talking a lot about the decoupling of the US and Chinese economies, lower trade. It's really beginning to show, and I think that's a little bit underreported because we talk of it as sort of a political movement that will have some effect down the line. But the share of Chinese goods as percentage of total US imports, if I remember correctly, has dropped off a cliff since COVID, basically.
Absolutely. And it's one-way traffic still.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not improving at all under Biden. I guess a lot of people expected Biden to sort of ease tensions globally in a way. To a certain extent, against China as well. Nothing is happening on that front.
Not at all.
If you look at the numbers. I mean, the tone of voice is conciliatory to a certain extent. From Yellen, she obviously went there and stuff like that. But I mean, if you look at the actual facts, nothing major has changed since the Trump presidency on this. Almost rather the contrary, if you ask me. So point being here that the direct exports from China to the US are off a cliff. Obviously, they do reroute some of these exports via LATAM. Yeah. But as soon as you introduce a middleman, that middleman wants to earn something. And you can see that from export price differences between China and Mexico, to just take that example, that there is some kind of value at a price at when you add a middleman. And Mexico is perfectly equipped to take advantage of this. That's why we see the Mexican peso performing still. And on top of that, given that we now see this inflation spike across the Americas, we've also seen positive inflation surprises in Brazil and Mexico lately. Would you rather trust Jay Powell or a central banker from Mexico in an inflation battle? I know. My choice. My choice is definitely a LATAM.
Yeah, the central bank inflation warriors. Yeah.
Because they know what they're dealing with. Mm. While most of the members of the committee in the US, obviously they have the wave from 21-22, but otherwise they've never dealt with it.
No.
And that's a big thing.
Yeah.
So I think counterintuitively, you find the two best inflation hedges with direct impact from this Chinese/Mexican story. And you can read the article to find out why.
Absolutely. Check that article out on, was released on Wednesday here. So just to sum up some news from our portfolio.
Yeah.
We've exited a couple of trades here on Thursday, Australian and Euro bonds.
Yeah. Well, the short answer to why is that, now that the US inflation story is clearly accelerating, we have a major divergence in pricing between the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, Bank of Canada, other G10 central banks, short term at least. And I'm not overly convinced that a lot of them dare to move aggressively away from the path of the Federal Reserve. I like the divergence narrative, but it's also very much priced in now. We were completely on top of this through Q1. And therefore, despite signs of goods deflation in Europe being more and more embedded, I don't think it's tactically wise to be long fixed income anywhere. I'm also scared of that commodity wave feeding through to prices other than dollar prices. And we know that the consumer in the US is probably stronger than elsewhere, but I don't think we will be completely without impact in Europe. So for the time being, despite this June meeting being live from the European Central Bank, I'm not overly convinced that the European Central Bank can outpace the cutting expectations already embedded in the forward curve. So they're basically priced to deliver 3 rate cuts from June until the end of the year in 5 meetings. So they have to do at least every other. It's not that aggressive, but if the Federal Reserve do not move at all, then it's pretty aggressive. So I guess the Federal Reserve is sort of pulling the rest of the pack towards some sort of gravitational force here on inflation.
Very interesting. Remember, you can check out our entire portfolio and our crypto portfolio as well.
Yes.
At stanresearch.com. Sign up for a free trial that gives you full access. Our portfolios are, of course, rooted very much in our macro regime model, which you can also check out. Was updated last week.
And we need the disclaimer from Gennaro Gattuso this week because, in all transparency, and that's what I love about macro, we had the inflation call absolutely spot on this week, and it caught everyone wrong-footed, including our own portfolio. So, I mean, we had everything right in macro and lost money.
Yeah.
Sorry, folks. I mean, it's not easy.
Trust your own analysis sometimes. Yeah. So remember that our ideas, recommendations may be sometimes.
Sometimes may be good. Sometimes may be shit.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Andreas.
Thank you, Miguel.
Great show. Thanks to Danny Dayan for joining us, and thank you all of you for listening or watching. We'll see you next week.